The luxury of his palace and table was hospitable and elegant. Whenever Maximus appeared in public, he was surrounded by a train of grateful and obsequious clients, and it is possible that among these clients he might deserve and possess some real friends. His merit was rewarded by the favor of the prince and senate. He thrice exercised the office of Praetorian Prefect of Italy. He was twice invested with the consulship, and he obtained the rank of patrician. These civil honors were not incompatible with the enjoyment of leisure and tranquility. His hours, according to the demands of pleasure or reason, were accurately distributed by water clock. And this avarice of time may be allowed to prove the sense which Maximus entertained of his own happiness. The injury which he received from the Emperor Valentinian appears to excuse the most bloody revenge. Yet a philosopher might have reflected that if the resistance of his wife had been sincere, her chastity was still inviolate, and that it could never be restored if she had consented to the will of the adulterer. A patriot would have hesitated before he plunged himself and his country into those inevitable calamities which must follow the extinction of the royal house of Theodosius. The imprudent Maximus disregarded these salutary considerations. He gratified his resentment and ambition. He saw the bleeding corpse of Valentinian at his feet, and he heard himself saluted emperor by the unanimous voice of the Senate and people. But the day of his inauguration was the last day of his happiness. He was imprisoned, such is the lively expression of Sidonius, in the palace, and after passing a sleepless night, he sighed that he had attained the summit of his wishes and aspired only to descend from the dangerous elevation. Oppressed by the weight of the diadem, he communicated his anxious thoughts to his friend and quaestor, Fulgentius, and when he looked back with unavailing regret on the secure pleasures of his former life, the emperor exclaimed, "O fortunate Damocles, thy reign began and ended with the same dinner," a well-known allusion which Fulgentius afterwards repeated as an instructive lesson for princes and subjects. The reign of Maximus continued about 3 months. His hours, of which he had lost the command, were disturbed by remorse, or guilt, or terror, and his throne was shaken by the seditions of the soldiers, the people, and the confederate barbarians. The marriage of his son, Palladius, with the eldest daughter of the late emperor, might tend to establish the hereditary succession of his family, but the violence which he offered to the Empress Eudoxia could proceed only from the blind impulse of lust or revenge. His own wife, the cause of these tragic events, had been seasonably removed by death, and the widow of Valentinian was compelled to violate her decent mourning, perhaps her real grief, and to submit to the embraces of a presumptuous usurper, whom she suspected as the assassin of her deceased husband. These suspicions were soon justified by the indiscreet confession of Maximus himself, and he wantonly provoked the hatred of his reluctant bride, who was still conscious that she was descended from a line of emperors. From the east, however, Eudoxia could not hope to obtain any effectual assistance. Her father and her aunt Pulcheria were dead. Her mother languished at Jerusalem in disgrace and exile, and the scepter of Constantinople was in the hands of a stranger. She directed her eyes towards Carthage, secretly implored the aid of the king of the Vandals, and persuaded Genseric to improve the fair opportunity of disguising his rapacious designs by the specious names of honor, justice, and compassion. Whatever abilities Maximus might have shown in a subordinate station, he was found incapable of administering an empire, and though he might easily have been informed of the naval preparations which were made on the opposite shores of Africa, he expected with supine indifference the approach of the enemy without adopting any measures of defense, of negotiation, or of a timely retreat. When the Vandals disembarked at the mouth of the Tiber, the emperor was suddenly roused from his lethargy by the clamors of a trembling and exasperated multitude. The only hope which presented itself to his astonished mind was that of a precipitate flight, and he exhorted the senators to imitate the example of their prince. But no sooner did Maximus appear in the streets than he was assaulted by a shower of stones. A Roman, or a Burgundian soldier, claimed the honour of the first wound. His mangled body was ignominiously cast into the Tiber. The Roman people rejoiced in the punishment which they had inflicted on the author of the public calamities, and the domestics of Eudoxia signalized their zeal in the service of their mistress. On the third day after the tumult, Genseric boldly advanced from the port of Ostia to the gates of the defenseless city. Instead of a sally of the Roman youth, there issued from the gates an unarmed and venerable procession of the bishop at the head of his clergy. The fearless spirit of Leo, his authority and eloquence, again mitigated the fierceness of a barbarian conqueror. The king of the Vandals promised to spare the unresisting multitude, to protect the buildings from fire, and to exempt the captives from torture. And although such orders were neither seriously given nor strictly obeyed, the mediation of Leo was glorious to himself and in some degree beneficial to his country. But Rome and its inhabitants were delivered to the licentiousness of the Vandals and Moors, whose blind passions revenged the injuries of Carthage. The pillage lasted 14 days and nights, and all that yet remained of public or private wealth, of sacred or profane treasure, was diligently transported to the vessels of Genseric. Among the spoils, the splendid relics of 2 temples, or rather of 2 religions, exhibited a memorable example of the vicissitudes of human and divine things. Since the abolition of paganism, the capital had been violated and abandoned, yet the statues of the gods and heroes were still respected, and the curious roof of gilt bronze was reserved for the rapacious hands of Genseric. The holy instruments of the Jewish worship, the gold table and the gold candlestick with 7 branches, originally framed according to the particular instructions of God himself, and which were placed in the sanctuary of his temple, had been ostentatiously displayed to the Roman people in the triumph of Titus. They were afterwards deposited in the Temple of Peace, and at the end of 400 years, the spoils of Jerusalem were transferred from Rome to Carthage by a barbarian who derived his origin from the shores of the Baltic. These ancient monuments might attract the notice of curiosity as well as of avarice. But the Christian churches, enriched and adorned by the prevailing superstition of the times, afforded more plentiful materials for sacrilege, and the pious liberality of Pope Leo, who melted 6 silver vases, the gift of Constantine, each of 100 pounds weight, is an evidence of the damage which he attempted to repair. In the 45 years that had elapsed since the Gothic invasion, the pomp and luxury of Rome were in some measure restored, and it was difficult either to escape or to satisfy the avarice of a conqueror who possessed leisure to collect and ships to transport the wealth of the capital. The imperial ornaments of the palace, the magnificent furniture and wardrobe, the sideboards of massy plate, were accumulated with disorderly rapine. The gold and silver amounted to several 1,000 talents. Yet even the brass and copper were laboriously removed. Eudoxia herself, who advanced to meet her friend and deliverer, soon bewailed the imprudence of her own conduct. She was rudely stripped of her jewels, and the unfortunate empress, with her 2 daughters, the only surviving remains of the great Theodosius, was compelled as a captive to follow the haughty Vandal, who immediately hoisted sail and returned with a prosperous navigation to the port of Carthage. Many 1,000 Romans of both sexes, chosen for some useful or agreeable qualifications, reluctantly embarked on board the fleet of Genseric, and their distress was aggravated by the unfeeling barbarians, who in the division of the booty separated the wives from their husbands and the children from their parents. The charity of Dio Gratius, Bishop of Carthage, was their only consolation and support. He generously sold the gold and silver plate of the church to purchase the freedom of some, to alleviate the slavery of others, and to assist the wants and infirmities of a captive multitude whose health was impaired by the hardships which they had suffered in their passage from Italy to Africa. By his order, two spacious churches were converted into hospitals. The sick were distributed into convenient beds and liberally supplied with food and medicines. And the aged prelate repeated his visits both in the day and night, with an assiduity that surpassed his strength, and a tender sympathy which enhanced the value of his services. Compare this scene with the field of Cannae, and judge between Hannibal and the successor of Saint Cyprian. The deaths of Aetius and Valentinian had relaxed the ties which held the barbarians of Gaul in peace and subordination. The seacoast was infested by the Saxons. The Alemanni and the Franks advanced from the Rhine to the Seine, and the ambition of the Goths seemed to meditate more extensive and permanent conquests. The Emperor Maximus relieved himself by judicious choice from the weight of these distant cares. He silenced the solicitations of his friends, listened to the voice of fame, and promoted a stranger to the general command of the forces of Gaul. Avitus, the stranger, whose merit was so nobly rewarded, descended from a wealthy and honorable family in the diocese of Auvergne. The convulsions of the times urged him to embrace with the same ardor the civil and military professions, and the indefatigable youth blended the studies of literature and jurisprudence with the exercise of arms and hunting. 30 years of his life were laudably spent in the public service. He alternately displayed his talents in war and negotiation, and the soldier of Aetius, after executing the most important embassies, was raised to the station of Praetorian Prefect of Gaul. Neither the merit of Avitus excited envy, or his moderation was desirous of repose, since he calmly retired to an estate which he possessed in the neighborhood of Clermont. A copious stream, issuing from the mountain and falling headlong in many a loud and foaming cascade, discharged its waters into a lake about 2 miles in length, and the villa was pleasantly seated on the margin of the lake. The baths, the porticos, the summer and winter apartments were adapted to the purposes of luxury and use, and the adjacent country afforded the various prospects of woods, pastures, and meadows. In this retreat, where Avitus amused his leisure with books, rural sports, the practice of husbandry, and the society of his friends, he received the imperial diploma, which constituted him Master General of the Cavalry and Infantry of Gaul. He assumed the military command. The barbarians suspended their fury, and whatever means he might employ, whatever concessions he might be forced to make, the people enjoyed the benefits of actual tranquility. But the fate of Gaul depended on the Visigoths, and the Roman general, less attentive to his dignity than to the public interest, did not disdain to visit Toulouse in the character of an ambassador. He was received with courteous hospitality by Theodoric, the king of the Goths. But while Avitus laid the foundations of a solid alliance with that powerful nation, he was astonished by the intelligence that the Emperor Maximus was slain, and that Rome had been pillaged by the Vandals. A vacant throne, which he might ascend without guilt or danger, tempted his ambition, and the Visigoths were easily persuaded to support his claim by their irresistible suffrage. They loved the person of Avitus. They respected his virtues, and they were not insensible of the advantage, as well as honor, of giving an emperor to the West. The season was now approaching in which the annual assembly of the 7 provinces was held at Arles. Their deliberations might perhaps be influenced by the presence of Theodoric and his martial brothers, but their choice would naturally incline to the most illustrious of their countrymen. Avitus, after a decent resistance, accepted the imperial diadem from the representatives of Gaul, and his election was ratified by the acclamations of the barbarians and provincials. The formal consent of Marcian, Emperor of the East, was solicited and obtained, but the Senate, Rome, and Italy, though humbled by their recent calamities, submitted with a secret murmur to the presumption of the Gallic usurper. Theodoric, to whom Avitus was indebted for the purple, had acquired the Gothic scepter by the murder of his elder brother Torismond, and he justified this atrocious deed by the design which his predecessor had formed of violating his alliance with the empire. Such a crime might not be incompatible with the virtues of a barbarian, but the manners of Theodoric were gentle and humane, and posterity may contemplate without terror the original picture of a Gothic king whom Sidonius had intimately observed in the hours of peace and of social intercourse. In an epistle dated from the court of Toulouse, the orator satisfies the curiosity of one of his friends in the following description. By the majesty of his appearance, Theodoric would command the respect of those who are ignorant of his merit. And although he is born a prince, his merit would dignify a private station. He is of a middle stature. His body appears rather plump than fat, and in his well-proportioned limbs, agility is united with muscular strength. If you examine his countenance, you will distinguish a high forehead, large shaggy eyebrows, an aquiline nose, thin lips, a regular set of white teeth, and a fair complexion that blushes more frequently from modesty than from anger. The ordinary distribution of his time, as far as it is exposed to the public view, may be concisely represented. Before daybreak he repairs with a small train to his domestic chapel, where the service is performed by the Arian clergy. But those who presume to interpret his secret sentiments consider this assiduous devotion as the effect of habit and policy. The rest of the morning is employed in the administration of his kingdom. His chair is surrounded by some military officers of decent aspect and behavior. The noisy crowd of his barbarian guards occupies the hall of audience, but they are not permitted to stand within the veils or curtains that conceal the council chamber from vulgar eyes. The ambassadors of the nations are successively introduced. Theodoric listens with attention, answers them with discreet brevity, and either announces or delays, according to the nature of their business, his final resolution. About 8, the second hour, he rises from his throne and visits either his treasury or his stables. If he chooses to hunt, or at least to exercise himself on horseback, his bow is carried by a favorite youth. But when the game is marked, he bends it with his own hand and seldom misses the object of his aim. As a king, he disdains to bear arms in such ignoble warfare. But as a soldier, he would blush to accept any military service which he could perform himself. On common days, his dinner is not different from the repast of a private citizen, but every Saturday, many honorable guests are invited to the royal table, which on these occasions is served with the elegance of Greece, the plenty of Gaul, and the order and diligence of Italy. The gold or silver plate is less remarkable for its weight than for the brightness and curious workmanship. The taste is gratified without the help of foreign and costly luxury. The size and number of the cups of wine are regulated with a strict regard to the laws of temperance, and the respectful silence that prevails is interrupted only by grave and instructive conversation. After dinner, Theodoric sometimes indulges himself in a short slumber, and as soon as he wakes, he calls for the dice and tables, encourages his friends to forget the royal majesty, and is delighted when they freely express the passions which are excited by the incidents of play. At this game, which he loves as the image of war, he alternately displays his eagerness, his skill, his patience, and his cheerful temper. If he loses, he laughs. He is modest and silent if he wins. Yet notwithstanding this seeming indifference, his courtiers choose to solicit any favour in the moments of victory, and I myself in my applications to the king have derived some benefit from my losses. About the 9th hour, 3 o'clock, the tide of business again returns and flows incessantly till after sunset, when the signal of the royal supper dismisses the weary crowd of suppliants and pleaders. At the supper, a more familiar repast, buffoons and pantomimes are sometimes introduced to divert, not to offend, the company by their ridiculous wit. But female singers and the soft, effeminate modes of music are severely banished, and such martial tunes as animate the soul to deeds of valour are alone grateful to the ear of Theodoric. He retires from table, and the nocturnal guards are immediately posted at the entrance of the treasury, the palace, and the private apartments. When the king of the Visigoths encouraged Avitus to assume the purple, he offered his person and his forces as a faithful soldier of the Republic. The exploits of Theodoric soon convinced the world that he had not degenerated from the warlike virtues of his ancestors. After the establishment of the Goths in Aquitaine and the passage of the Vandals into Africa, the Suevi, who had fixed their kingdom in Galicia, aspired to the conquest of Spain, and threatened to extinguish the feeble remains of the Roman dominion. The provincials of Carthagena and Tarragona, afflicted by a hostile invasion, represented their injuries and their apprehensions. Count Fronto was dispatched in the name of the Emperor Avitus with advantageous offers of peace and alliance. Then Theodoric interposed his weighty mediation to declare that unless his brother-in-law, the king of the Suevi, immediately retired, he should be obliged to arm in the cause of justice and of Rome. "Tell him," replied the haughty Ricciarius, "that I despise his friendship and his arms, but that I shall soon try whether he will dare to expect my arrival under the walls of Toulouse." Such a challenge urged Theodoric to prevent the bold designs of his enemy. He passed the Pyrenees at the head of the Visigoths. The Franks and Burgundians served under his standard, and though he professed himself the dutiful servant of Avitus, he privately stipulated for himself and his successors the absolute possession of his Spanish conquests. The two armies, or rather the two nations, encountered each other on the banks of the river Urbicus, about 12 miles from Astorga, and the decisive victory of the Goths appeared for a while to have extirpated the name and kingdom of the Suevi. From the field of battle, Theodoric advanced to Braga, their metropolis, which still retained the splendid vestiges of its ancient commerce and dignity. His entrance was not polluted with blood, and the Goths respected the chastity of their female captives, more especially of the consecrated virgins. But the greatest part of the clergy and people were made slaves, and even the churches and altars were confounded in the universal pillage. The unfortunate king of the Suevi had escaped to one of the ports of the ocean, but the obstinacy of the winds opposed his flight. He was delivered to his implacable rival, and Ricciarius, who neither desired nor expected mercy, received with manly constancy the death which he would probably have inflicted. After this bloody sacrifice to policy or resentment, Theodoric carried his victorious arms as far as Merida, the principal town of Lusitania, without meeting any resistance except from the miraculous powers of St. Eulalia. But he was stopped in the full career of success and recalled from Spain before he could provide for the security of his conquests. In his retreat towards the Pyrenees, he revenged his disappointment on the country through which he passed, and in the sack of Palencia and Astorga, he showed himself a faithless ally, as well as a cruel enemy. Whilst the king of the Visigoths fought and vanquished in the name of Avitus, the reign of Avitus had expired. And both the honour and the interest of Theodoric were deeply wounded by the disgrace of a friend whom he had seated on the throne of the Western Empire. Part 2. The pressing solicitations of the Senate and people persuaded the Emperor Avitus to fix his residence at Rome and to accept the consulship for the ensuing year. On the first day of January, his son-in-law, Sidonius Apollinaris, celebrated his praises in a panegyric of 600 verses. But this composition, though it was rewarded with a brass statue, seems to contain a very moderate proportion either of genius or of truth. The poet, if we may degrade that sacred name, exaggerates the merit of a sovereign and a father, and his prophecy of a long and glorious reign was soon contradicted by the event. Avitus, at a time when the imperial dignity was reduced to a preeminence of toil and danger, indulged himself in the pleasures of Italian luxury. Age had not extinguished his amorous inclinations, and he is accused of insulting, with indiscreet and ungenerous raillery, the husbands whose wives he had seduced or violated. But the Romans were not inclined either to excuse his faults or to acknowledge his virtues. The several parts of the empire became every day more alienated from each other, and the stranger of Gaul was the object of popular hatred and contempt. The Senate asserted their legitimate claim in the election of an emperor, and their authority, which had been originally derived from the old constitution, was again fortified by the actual weakness of a declining monarchy. Yet even such a monarchy might have resisted the votes of an unarmed Senate if their discontent had not been supported, or perhaps inflamed, by the Count Ricimer, one of the principal commanders of the barbarian troops who form the military defense of Italy. The daughter of Valia, king of the Visigoths, was the mother of Ricimer, but he was descended on the father's side from the nation of the Suevi. His pride or patriotism might be exasperated by the misfortunes of his countrymen, and he obeyed with reluctance an emperor in whose elevation he had not been consulted. His faithful and important services against the common enemy rendered him still more formidable, and after destroying on the coast of Corsica a fleet of Vandals, which consisted of 60 galleys, Ricimer returned in triumph with the appellation of the Deliverer of Italy. He chose that moment to signify to Avitus that his reign was at an end, and the feeble emperor, at a distance from his Gothic allies, was compelled, after a short and unavailing struggle, to abdicate the purple. By the clemency, however, or the contempt of Ricimer, he was permitted to descend from the throne to the more desirable station of Bishop of Placentia. But the resentment of the Senate was still unsatisfied, and their inflexible severity pronounced the sentence of his death. He fled towards the Alps with the humble hope not of arming the Visigoths in his cause, but of securing his person and treasures in the sanctuary of Julian, one of the tutelar saints of Auvergne. Disease or the hand of the executioner arrested him on the road, yet his remains were decently transported to Brivath, or Brude, in his native province, and he reposed at the feet of his holy patron. Avitus left only one daughter, the wife of Sidonius Apollinaris, who inherited the patrimony of his father-in-law, lamenting at the same time the disappointment of his public and private expectations. His resentment prompted him to join, or at least to countenance, the measures of a rebellious faction in Gaul, and the poet had contracted some guilt which it was incumbent on him to expiate by a new tribute of flattery to the succeeding emperor. The successor of Avitus presents the welcome discovery of a great and heroic character, such as sometimes arise in a degenerate age to vindicate the honor of the human species. The emperor Majorian has deserved the praises of his contemporaries and of posterity, and these praises may be strongly expressed in the words of a judicious and disinterested historian. that he was gentle to his subjects, that he was terrible to his enemies, and that he excelled in every virtue all his predecessors who had reigned over the Romans. Such a testimony may justify at least the panegyric of Sidonius, and we may acquiesce in the assurance that, although the obsequious orator would have flattered with equal zeal the most worthless of princes, the extraordinary merit of his object confined him on this occasion within the bounds of truth. Majorian derived his name from his maternal grandfather, who in the reign of the great Theodosius had commanded the troops of the Illyrian frontier. He gave his daughter in marriage to the father of Majorian, a respectable officer who administered the revenues of Gaul with skill and integrity, and generously preferred the friendship of Aetius to the tempting offer of an insidious court. His son, the future emperor, who was educated in the profession of arms, displayed from his early youth intrepid courage, premature wisdom, and unbounded liberality in a scanty fortune. He followed the standard of Aetius, contributed to his success, shared and sometimes eclipsed his glory, and at last excited the jealousy of the patrician, or rather of his wife, who forced him to retire from the service. Majorian, after the death of Aetius, was recalled and promoted, and his intimate connection with Count Ricimer was the immediate step by which he ascended the throne of the Western Empire. During the vacancy that succeeded the abdication of Avitus, the ambitious barbarian, whose birth excluded him from the imperial dignity, governed Italy with the title of patrician. Resigned to his friend the conspicuous station of master general of the cavalry and infantry, and after an interval of some months, consented to the unanimous wish of the Romans, whose favour Majorian had solicited by recent victory over the Alemanni. He was invested with the purple at Ravenna, and the epistle which he addressed to the Senate will best describe his situation and his sentiments. "Your election, conscript fathers, and the ordnance of the most valiant army have made me your emperor. May the propitious deity direct and prosper the counsels and events of my administration to your advantage and to the public welfare. For my own part, I did not aspire, I have submitted to reign, nor should I have discharged the obligations of a citizen if I had refused, with base and selfish ingratitude, to support the weight of those labours which were imposed by the Republic. Assist, therefore, the prince whom you have made. Partake the duties which you have enjoined. And may our common endeavours promote the happiness of an empire which I have accepted from your hands. Be assured that in our times justice shall resume her ancient vigour, and that virtue shall become not only innocent, but meritorious. Let none except the authors themselves be apprehensive of delations, which, as a subject, I have always condemned, and as a prince will severely punish. Our own vigilance and that of our father, the patrician Ricimer, shall regulate all military affairs and provide for the safety of the Roman world, which we have saved from foreign and domestic enemies. You now understand the maxims of my government. You may confide in the faithful love and sincere assurances of a prince who has formerly been the companion of your life and dangers, who still glories in the name of senator, and who is anxious that you should never repent the judgment which you have pronounced in his favour. The emperor, who amidst the ruins of the Roman world revived the ancient language of law and liberty, which Trajan would not have disclaimed, must have derived those generous sentiments from his own heart, since they were not suggested to his imitation by the customs of his age or the example of his predecessors. The private and public actions of Majorian are very imperfectly known, but his laws, remarkable for an original cast of thought and expression, faithfully represent the character of a sovereign who loved his people, who sympathized in their distress, who had studied the causes of the decline of the empire, and who was capable of applying, as far as such reformation was practicable, judicious and effectual remedies to the public disorders. His regulations concerning the finances manifestly tended to remove, or at least to mitigate, the most intolerable grievances. 1. From the first hour of his reign, he was solicitous, I translate his own words, to relieve the weary fortunes of the provincials oppressed by the accumulated weight of indictions and superindictions. With this view, he granted a universal amnesty, a final and absolute discharge of all arrears of tribute, of all debts which, under any pretense, the fiscal officers might demand from the people. This wise dereliction of absolute, vexatious, and unprofitable claims improved and purified the sources of the public revenue, and the subject, who could now look back without despair, might labor with hope and gratitude for himself and for his country. 2. In the assessment and collection of taxes, Majorian restored the ordinary jurisdiction of the provincial magistrates, and suppressed the extraordinary commissions which had been introduced in the name of the emperor himself or of the praetorian prefects. The favorite servants who obtained such irregular powers were insolent in their behavior and arbitrary in their demands. They affected to despise the subordinate tribunals, and they were discontented if their fees and profits did not twice exceed the sum which they condescended to pay into the treasury. One instance of their extortion would appear incredible were it not authenticated by the legislator himself. They exacted the whole payment in gold, but they refused the current coin of the empire, and would only accept such ancient pieces as were stamped with the names of Faustina or the Antonines. The subject, who was unprovided with these curious medals, had recourse to the expedient of compounding with their rapacious demands, or if he succeeded in the research, his imposition was doubled according to the weight and value of the money of former times. 3. The municipal corporations, says the emperor, the lesser senates, so antiquity has justly styled them, deserve to be considered as the heart of the cities and the sinews of the republic. And yet so low are they now reduced by the injustice of magistrates and the venality of collectors, that many of their members, renouncing their dignity and their country, have taken refuge in distant and obscure exile. He urges and even compels their return to their respective cities, but he removes the grievance which had forced them to desert the exercise of their municipal functions. They are directed under the authority of the provincial magistrates to resume their office of levying the tribute, but instead of being made responsible for the whole sum assessed on their district, they are only required to produce a regular account of the payments which they have actually received and of the defaulters who are still indebted to the public. 4. But Majorian was not ignorant that these corporate bodies were too much inclined to retaliate the injustice and oppression which they had suffered, and he therefore revives the useful office of the Defenders of Cities. He exhorts the people to elect in a full and free assembly some man of discretion and integrity, who would dare to assert their privileges, to represent their grievances, to protect the poor from the tyranny of the rich, and to inform the emperor of the abuses that were committed under the sanction of his name and authority. The spectator who casts a mournful view over the ruins of ancient Rome is tempted to accuse the memory of the Goths and Vandals for the mischief which they had neither leisure nor power, nor perhaps inclination, to perpetrate. The tempest of war might strike some lofty turrets to the ground, but the destruction which undermined the foundations of those massive fabrics was prosecuted slowly and silently during a period of 10 centuries, and the motives of interest that afterwards operated without shame or control were severely checked by the taste and spirit of the Emperor Majorian. The decay of the city had gradually impaired the value of the public works. The circus and theatres might still excite, but they seldom gratified the desires of the people. The temples, which had escaped the zeal of the Christians, were no longer inhabited either by gods or men. The diminished crowds of the Romans were lost in the immense space of their baths and porticos, and the stately libraries and halls of justice became useless to an indolent generation whose repose was seldom disturbed, either by study or business. The monuments of consular or imperial greatness were no longer revered as the immortal glory of the capital. They were only esteemed as an inexhaustible mine of materials, cheaper and more convenient than the distant quarry. Specious petitions were continually addressed to the easy magistrates of Rome, which stated the want of stones or bricks for some necessary service. The fairest forms of architecture were rudely defaced for the sake of some paltry or pretended repairs, and the degenerate Romans, who converted the spoil to their own emolument, demolished with sacrilegious hands the labors of their ancestors. Majorian, who had often sighed over the desolation of the city, applied a severe remedy to the growing evil. He reserved to the prince and senate the sole cognizance of the extreme cases which might justify the destruction of an ancient edifice, imposed a fine of 50 pounds of gold, 2,000 pounds sterling, on every magistrate who should presume to grant such illegal and scandalous license, and threatened to chastise the criminal obedience of their subordinate officers by a severe whipping and the amputation of both their hands. In the last instance, the legislator might seem to forget the proportion of guilt and punishment, but his zeal arose from a generous principle, and Majorian was anxious to protect the monuments of those ages in which he would have desired and deserved to live. The emperor conceived that it was his interest to increase the number of his subjects, and that it was his duty to guard the purity of the marriage bed. But the means which he employed to accomplish these salutary purposes are of an ambiguous and perhaps exceptionable kind. The pious maids who consecrated their virginity to Christ were restrained from taking the veil till they had reached their 40th year. Widows under that age were compelled to form a second alliance within the term of 5 years by the forfeiture of half their wealth to their nearest relations or to the state. Unequal marriages were condemned or annulled. The punishment of confiscation and exile was deemed so inadequate to the guilt of adultery that if the criminal returned to Italy, he might, by the express declaration of Majorian, be slain with impunity. While the Emperor Majorian assiduously labored to restore the happiness and virtue of the Romans, he encountered the arms of Genseric, from his character and situation, their most formidable enemy. A fleet of Vandals and Moors landed at the mouth of the Liris, or Garigliano, but the imperial troops surprised and attacked the disorderly barbarians who were encumbered with the spoils of Campania. They were chased with slaughter to their ships, and their leader, the king's brother-in-law, was found in the number of the slain. Such vigilance might announce the character of the new reign, but the strictest vigilance and the most numerous forces were insufficient to protect the long-extended coast of Italy from the depredations of a naval war. The public opinion had imposed a nobler and more arduous task on the genius of Majorian. Rome expected from him alone the restitution of Africa, and the design which he formed of attacking the Vandals in their new settlements was the result of bold and judicious policy. If the intrepid emperor could have infused his own spirit into the youth of Italy, if he could have revived in the field of Mars the manly exercises in which he had always surpassed his equals, he might have marched against Genseric at the head of a Roman army. Such a reformation of national manners might be embraced by the rising generation. But it is the misfortune of those princes who laboriously sustain a declining monarchy that to obtain some immediate advantage or to avert some impending danger, they are forced to countenance and even to multiply the most pernicious abuses. Majorian, like the weakest of his predecessors, was reduced to the disgraceful expedient of substituting barbarian auxiliaries in the place of his unwarlike subjects, and his superior abilities could only be displayed in the vigor and dexterity with which he wielded a dangerous instrument, so apt to recoil on the hand that used it. Besides the Confederates who were already engaged in the service of the Empire, the fame of his liberality and valor attracted the nations of the Danube, the Borysthenes, and perhaps of the Tanais. Many thousands of the bravest subjects of Attila, the Gepidi, the Ostrogoths, the Rugians, the Burgundians, the Suevi, the Alani, assembled in the plains of Liguria, and their formidable strength was balanced by their mutual animosities. They passed the Alps in a severe winter. The emperor led the way on foot and in complete armor, sounding with his long staff the depth of the ice or snow and encouraging the Scythians, who complained of the extreme cold, by the cheerful assurance that they should be satisfied with the heat of Africa. The citizens of Lyon had presumed to shut their gates. They soon implored and experienced the clemency of Majorian. He vanquished Theodoric in the field, and admitted to his friendship and alliance a king whom he had found not unworthy of his arms. The beneficial, though precarious, reunion of the greater part of Gaul and Spain was the effect of persuasion as well as of force, and the independent Bagaudi, who had escaped or resisted the oppression of former reigns, were disposed to confide in the virtues of Majorian. His camp was filled with barbarian allies. His throne was supported by the zeal of an affectionate people. But the emperor had foreseen that it was impossible without a maritime power to achieve the conquest of Africa. In the First Punic War, the Republic had exerted such incredible diligence that within 60 days after the first stroke of the axe had been given in the forest, a fleet of 160 galleys proudly rode at anchor in the sea. Under circumstances much less favorable, Majorian equaled the spirit and perseverance of the ancient Romans. The woods of the Apennine were felled. The arsenals and manufactures of Ravenna and Misenum were restored. Italy and Gaul vied with each other in liberal contributions to the public service, and the imperial navy of 300 large galleys, with an adequate proportion of transports and smaller vessels, was collected in the secure and capacious harbor of Carthagena in Spain. The intrepid countenance of Majorian animated his troops with a confidence of victory, and if we might credit the historian Procopius, his courage sometimes hurried him beyond the bounds of prudence. Anxious to explore with his own eyes the state of the Vandals, he ventured, after disguising the color of his hair, to visit Carthage in the character of his own ambassador. And Genseric was afterwards mortified by the discovery that he had entertained and dismissed the emperor of the Romans. Such an anecdote may be rejected as an improbable fiction, but it is a fiction which would not have been imagined unless in the life of a hero. Part 3. Without the help of a personal interview, Genseric was sufficiently acquainted with the genius and designs of his adversary. He practiced his customary arts of fraud and delay, but he practiced them without success. His applications for peace became each hour more submissive, and perhaps more sincere. But the inflexible Majorian had adopted the ancient maxim that Rome could not be safe as long as Carthage existed in a hostile state. The king of the Vandals distrusted the valor of his native subjects, who were enervated by the luxury of the south. He suspected the fidelity of the vanquished people, who abhorred him as an Arian tyrant, and the desperate measure which he executed of reducing Mauritania into a desert could not defeat the operations of the Roman emperor, who was at liberty to land his troops on any part of the African coast. but Genseric was saved from impending and inevitable ruin by the treachery of some powerful subjects, envious or apprehensive of their master's success. Guided by their secret intelligence, he surprised the unguarded fleet in the Bay of Carthagena. Many of the ships were sunk or taken or burnt, and the preparations of 3 years were destroyed in a single day. After this event, the behavior of the two antagonists showed them superior to their fortune. The Vandal, instead of being elated by this accidental victory, immediately renewed his solicitations for peace. The Emperor of the West, who was capable of forming great designs and of supporting heavy disappointments, consented to a treaty, or rather to a suspension of arms, in the full assurance that before he could restore his navy, he should be supplied with provocations to justify a second war. Majorian returned to Italy to prosecute his labors for the public happiness, and as he was conscious of his own integrity, he might long remain ignorant of the dark conspiracy which threatened his throne and his life. The recent misfortune of Carthagena sullied the glory which had dazzled the eyes of the multitude. Almost every description of civil and military officers were exasperated against the reformer, since they all derived some advantage from the abuses which he endeavored to suppress. And the patrician Ricimer impelled the inconstant passions of the barbarians against a prince whom he esteemed and hated. The virtues of Majorian could not protect him from the impetuous sedition which broke out in the camp near Tortona at the foot of the Alps. He was compelled to abdicate the imperial purple. 5 days after his abdication, it was reported that he died of a dysentery, and the humble tomb which covered his remains was consecrated by the respect and gratitude of succeeding generations. The private character of Majorian inspired love and respect. Malicious calumny and satire excited his indignation, or, if he himself were the object, his contempt. But he protected the freedom of wit, and in the hours which the emperor gave to the familiar society of his friends, he could indulge his taste for pleasantry without degrading the majesty of his rank. It was perhaps without some regret that Ricimer sacrificed his friend to the interest of his ambition. But he resolved in a second choice to avoid the imprudent preference of superior virtue and merit. At his command, the obsequious Senate of Rome bestowed the imperial title on Laebius Severus, who ascended the throne of the West without emerging from the obscurity of a private condition. History has scarcely deigned to notice his birth, his elevation, his character, or his death. Severus expired as soon as his life became inconvenient to his patron, and it would be useless to discriminate his nominal reign in the vacant interval of 6 years between the death of Majorian and the elevation of Anthemius. During that period, the government was in the hands of Ricimer alone, and although the modest barbarian disclaimed the name of king, he accumulated treasures, formed a separate army, negotiated private alliances, and ruled Italy with the same independent and despotic authority which was afterwards exercised by Odoacer and Theodoric. But his dominions were bounded by the Alps, and two Roman generals, Marcellinus and Aegidius, maintained their allegiance to the Republic by rejecting with disdain the phantom which he styled an emperor. Marcellinus still adhered to the old religion, and the devout pagans, who secretly disobeyed the laws of the church and state, applauded his profound skill in the science of divination. But he possessed the more valuable qualifications of learning, virtue, and courage. The study of the Latin literature had improved his taste, and his military talents had recommended him to the esteem and confidence of the great Aetius, in whose ruin he was involved. By a timely flight, Marcellinus escaped the rage of Valentinian, and boldly asserted his liberty amidst the convulsions of the Western Empire. His voluntary or reluctant submission to the authority of Majorian was rewarded by the government of Sicily, and the command of an army stationed in that island to oppose or to attack the Vandals. but his barbarian mercenaries, after the emperor's death, were tempted to revolt by the artful liberality of Ricimer. At the head of a band of faithful followers, the intrepid Marcellinus occupied the province of Dalmatia, assumed the title of Patrician of the West, secured the love of his subjects by a mild and equitable reign, built a fleet which claimed the dominion of the Adriatic, and alternately alarmed the coasts of Italy and of Africa. Aegidius, the master general of Gaul, who equaled or at least who imitated the heroes of ancient Rome, proclaimed his immortal resentment against the assassins of his beloved master. A brave and numerous army was attached to his standard, and though he was prevented by the arts of Ricimer and the arms of the Visigoths from marching to the gates of Rome, he maintained his independent sovereignty beyond the Alps, and rendered the name of Aegidius respectable both in peace and war. The Franks, who had punished with exile the youthful follies of Childeric, elected the Roman general for their king. His vanity, rather than his ambition, was gratified by that singular honour. And when the nation, at the end of 4 years, repented of the injury which they had offered to the Merovingian family, he patiently acquiesced in the restoration of the lawful prince. The authority of Aegidius ended only with his life, and the suspicions of poison and secret violence, which derived some countenance from the character of Ricimer, were eagerly entertained by the passionate credulity of the Gauls. The Kingdom of Italy, an aim to which the Western Empire was gradually reduced, was afflicted under the reign of Ricimer by the incessant depredations of the Vandal pirates. In the spring of each year they equipped a formidable navy in the port of Carthage, and Genseric himself, though in a very advanced age, still commanded in person the most important expeditions. His designs were concealed with impenetrable secrecy till the moment that he hoisted sail. When he was asked by his pilot what course he should steer, "Leave the determination to the winds," replied the barbarian with pious arrogance. "They will transport us to the guilty coast whose inhabitants have provoked the divine justice." But if Genseric himself deigned to issue more precise orders, he judged the most wealthy to be the most criminal. The Vandals repeatedly visited the coasts of Spain, Liguria, Tuscany, Campania, Lucania, Bruttium, Apulia, Calabria, Venetia, Dalmatia, Epirus, Greece, and Sicily. They were tempted to subdue the island of Sardinia, so advantageously placed in the center of the Mediterranean, and their arms spread desolation or terror from the columns of Hercules to the mouth of the Nile. As they were more ambitious of spoil than of glory, they seldom attacked any fortified cities or engaged any regular troops in the open field. But the celerity of their motions enabled them, almost at the same time, to threaten and to attack the most distant objects which attracted their desires. And as they always embarked a sufficient number of horses, they had no sooner landed than they swept the dismayed country with a body of light cavalry. Yet notwithstanding the example of their king, the native Vandals and Alani insensibly declined this toilsome and perilous warfare. The hardy generation of the first conquerors was almost extinguished, and their sons, who were born in Africa, enjoyed the delicious baths and gardens which had been acquired by the valour of their fathers. Their place was readily supplied by a various multitude of Moors and Romans, of captives and outlaws. And those desperate wretches who had already violated the laws of their country were the most eager to promote the atrocious acts which disgraced the victories of Genseric. In the treatment of his unhappy prisoners, he sometimes consulted his avarice, and sometimes indulged his cruelty. And the massacre of 500 noble citizens of Zant, or Zanchethus, whose mangled bodies he cast into the Ionian Sea, was imputed by the public indignation to his latest posterity. Such crimes could not be excused by any provocations. But the war which the king of the Vandals prosecuted against the Roman Empire was justified by a specious and reasonable motive. the widow of Valentinian, Eudoxia, whom he had led captive from Rome to Carthage, was the sole heiress of the Theodosian house. Her elder daughter, Eudokia, became the reluctant wife of Hunneric, his eldest son, and the stern father, asserting a legal claim which could not easily be refuted or satisfied, demanded a just proportion of the imperial patrimony. An adequate, or at least a valuable, compensation was offered by the Eastern Emperor to purchase a necessary peace. Eudoxia and her younger daughter Placidia were honorably restored, and the fury of the Vandals was confined to the limits of the Western Empire. The Italians, destitute of a naval force which alone was capable of protecting their coasts, implored the aid of the more fortunate nations of the East, who had formerly acknowledged, in peace and war, the supremacy of Rome. But the perpetual divisions of the two empires had alienated their interest and their inclinations. The faith of a recent treaty was alleged, and the Western Romans, instead of arms and ships, could only obtain the assistance of a cold and ineffectual mediation. The haughty Ricimer, who had long struggled with the difficulties of his situation, was at length reduced to address the throne of Constantinople in the humble language of a subject, and Italy submitted, as the price and security, to accept a master from the choice of the Emperor of the East. It is not the purpose of the present chapter, nor even of the present volume, to continue the distinct series of the Byzantine history, but a concise view of the reign and character of the Emperor Leo may explain the last efforts that were attempted to save the falling empire of the West. Since the death of the younger Theodosius, the domestic repose of Constantinople had never been interrupted by war or faction. Pulcheria had bestowed her hand and the scepter of the East on the modest virtue of Marcian. He gratefully reverenced her august rank and virgin chastity, and after her death he gave his people the example of the religious worship that was due to the memory of the imperial saint. Attentive to the prosperity of his own dominions, Marcian seemed to behold with indifference the misfortunes of Rome, and the obstinate refusal of a brave and active prince to draw his sword against the Vandals was ascribed to a secret promise which had formerly been exacted from him when he was a captive in the power of Genseric. The death of Marcian, after a reign of 7 years, would have exposed the East to the danger of a popular election, if the superior weight of a single family had not been able to incline the balance in favor of the candidate whose interest they supported. The patrician Aspar might have placed the diadem on his own head if he would have subscribed the Nicene Creed. During 3 generations the armies of the East were successively commanded by his father, by himself, and by his son Ardaburius. His barbarian guards formed a military force that overawed the palace and the capital, and the liberal distribution of his immense treasures rendered Aspar as popular as he was powerful. He recommended the obscure name of Leo of Thrace, a military tribune and the principal steward of his household. His nomination was unanimously ratified by the Senate, and the servant of Aspar received the imperial crown from the hands of the patriarch or bishop, who was permitted to express by this unusual ceremony the suffrage of the deity. This emperor, the first of the name of Leo, has been distinguished by the title of the Great, from a succession of princes who gradually fixed in the opinion of the Greeks a very humble standard of heroic, or at least of royal, perfection. Yet the temperate firmness with which Leo resisted the oppression of his benefactor showed that he was conscious of his duty and of his prerogative. Aspar was astonished to find that his influence could no longer appoint a prefect of Constantinople. He presumed to reproach his sovereign with a breach of promise, and insolently shaking his purple, "It is not proper," said he, "that the man who is invested with this garment should be guilty of lying." "Nor is it proper," replied Leo, "that a prince should be compelled to resign his own judgment and the public interest to the will of a subject." After this extraordinary scene, it was impossible that the reconciliation of the emperor and the patrician could be sincere, or at least that it could be solid and permanent. An army of Isaurians was secretly levied and introduced into Constantinople, and while Leo undermined the authority and prepared the disgrace of the family of Aspar, his mild and cautious behavior restrained them from any rash and desperate attempts which might have been fatal to themselves or their enemies. The measures of peace and war were affected by this internal revolution. As long as Aspar degraded the majesty of the throne, the secret correspondence of religion and interest engaged him to favor the cause of Genseric. When Leo had delivered himself from that ignominious servitude, he listened to the complaints of the Italians, resolved to extirpate the tyranny of the Vandals, and declared his alliance with his colleague Anthemius, whom he solemnly invested with the diadem and purple of the West. The virtues of Anthemius have perhaps been magnified since the imperial descent, which he could only deduce from the usurper Procopius, has been swelled into a line of emperors. But the merit of his immediate parents, their honors and their riches, rendered Anthemius one of the most illustrious subjects of the East. His father, Procopius, obtained, after his Persian embassy, the rank of general and patrician, and the name of Anthemius was derived from his maternal grandfather, the celebrated prefect who protected with so much ability and success the infant reign of Theodosius. The grandson of the prefect was raised above the condition of a private subject by his marriage with Euphemia, the daughter of the Emperor Martian. This splendid alliance, which might supersede the necessity of merit, hastened the promotion of Anthemius to the successive dignities of count, of master general, of consul, and of patrician. And his merit or fortune claimed the honors of a victory which was obtained on the banks of the Danube over the Huns. Without indulging an extravagant ambition, the son-in-law of Martian might hope to be his successor. But Anthemius supported the disappointment with courage and patience, and his subsequent elevation was universally approved by the public, who esteemed him worthy to reign till he ascended the throne. The Emperor of the West marched from Constantinople, attended by several counts of high distinction and a body of guards almost equal to the strength and number of a regular army. He entered Rome in triumph, and the choice of Leo was confirmed by the Senate, the people, and the barbarian confederates of Italy. The solemn inauguration of Anthemius was followed by the nuptials of his daughter and the patrician Ricimer, a fortunate event which was considered as the firmest security of the union and happiness of the state. The wealth of two empires was ostentatiously displayed, and many senators completed their ruin by an expensive effort to disguise their poverty. All serious business was suspended during this festival. The courts of justice were shut. The streets of Rome, the theatres, the places of public and private resort resounded with hymeneal songs and dances, and the royal bride, clothed in silken robes, with a crown on her head, was conducted to the palace of Ricimer, who had changed his military dress for the habit of a consul and a senator. On this memorable occasion, Sidonius, whose early ambition had been so fatally blasted, appeared as the orator of Auvergne, among the provincial deputies who addressed the throne with congratulations or complaints. The calends of January were now approaching, and the venal poet who had loved Avitus and esteemed Majorian was persuaded by his friends to celebrate in heroic verse the merit, the felicity,